KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
It just looked like nuclear warfare, really. I mean, it was buildings burned down, things that were unrecognizable.
One homeowner and what's happening after losing everything in the ongoing LA fires. For Sunday, January 12th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Ahead, why Meta killed fact-checking and what it means for information on the internet. And more from our exit interview with Pete Buttigieg, who, along with other members of the Biden administration, is wrestling with how much of his work the incoming Trump White House may try to undo.
I know that regulation is a popular punching bag, but we should remember that when we get it right, the results are extraordinary.
Plus, Ringo Starr goes country.
If you're listening to, you know, roots-based American music, you're like, these songs are all great.
Those stories and more after this newscast. Stick around.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. Los Angeles firefighters expect conditions to worsen as they continue to fight deadly wildfires in the area. Officials are investigating at least 16 deaths in connection to what California Governor Gavin Newsom says could end up being the worst natural disaster in U.S. history. Elise Hugh has the latest from Los Angeles.
Two of the largest fires burning, the Eaton Fire in Altadena and Pasadena and the Coastal Palisades Fire, remain largely uncontained ahead of windier conditions expected to move in by Monday. Aerial firefighters have laid down fire retardant over the mountains, painting the peaks in red lines. Crews from other states, Mexico, and Canada have joined in the firefighting effort. Governor Newsom said more than 14,000 personnel are involved in the effort to control the fires. L.A. County Fire Chief Anthony Maroney said Sunday crews have the resources they need in the days ahead. For NPR News, I'm Elise Hugh in Los Angeles.
Animal rescue operations are in high gear in the region. Rachel Miro from member station KQED has details on Pasadena Humane, looking after animals affected by the Eaton Fire in Southern California.
Pasadena Humane has taken in more than 400 animals, including dogs, cats, bunnies, cockatoos, goats, wild birds, even a pony. President and CEO Dia DuVernet says 150 employees, including five full-time veterinarians, are working around the clock.
This organization has served through two world wars, a Great Depression. We did the pandemic. We can handle whatever comes our way.
She says search and rescue teams are out now looking for survivors and victims. For those animals that were microchipped, the owners can be contacted. For NPR News, I'm Rachel Miro in Pasadena.
Ceasefire talks underway in Qatar were the focus of today's talks between President Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The negotiations aim to bring about a ceasefire in Gaza after more than a year of war. The latest talks would see Israeli hostages released in exchange for Palestinian detainees. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports.
The two leaders discussed, quote, progress in the negotiations, according to a brief statement from the prime minister's office. A readout from the White House after the phone call said that Biden, quote, stressed the immediate need for a ceasefire in Gaza and return of the hostages with a surge in humanitarian aid. The call was just a day after President-elect Trump's new envoy to the region, Steve Witkoff, made a surprise visit to Israel to meet with Netanyahu. Witkoff had been attending the talks in Doha. Meanwhile, fighting in Gaza remains deadly. At least 28 Palestinians were killed in the past day, according to health officials there. Four Israeli soldiers were also killed, according to the military. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
This is NPR. The Los Angeles Unified School District says it plans to reopen most schools on Monday. The district shuttered all buildings late Wednesday as the fire situation worsened across the county. In a robocall message to parents this evening, the district said conditions have improved and the district is confident it's safe for students and employees to return to campuses. In that recording, it said some schools in the highest impact areas will remain closed. Officials in Japan are joining those in the U.S. in accusing China of launching aggressive cyber attacks and spying on critical infrastructure. NPR's Jenna McLaughlin reports.
Cybersecurity officials in Japan say that a Chinese hacking group has been targeting Japanese businesses, organizations, and individuals since 2019. They call that group Mirror Face. According to the officials, the Chinese hacking group has been trying to steal information relating to Japanese national security and technology. The advisory comes at a time when U.S. officials say Chinese hacking groups are also buried deep within U.S. critical infrastructure, from telecoms to military systems. They're not only spying, but also hoping to secure a foothold in vital systems, in case it gives China an advantage in a possible future conflict. Jen McLaughlin, NPR News.
The app that facilitates TikTok, owned by China-based parent company ByteDance, could vanish from U.S. app stores by the end of this coming week. If the U.S. Supreme Court rules this way, people who have already downloaded it to their devices will continue to have access, but for most, updates won't be available. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at MelvilleTrust.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. The National Weather Service says Los Angeles and Ventura counties are under high wildfire risk through Wednesday. That's because the dry, gusty winds that have fueled the fires are expected to pick back up and could exacerbate the already devastating fires. One of the hardest hit areas is a neighborhood called Altadena. Many of those people have learned that the homes they left behind were burned to the ground. Joan Nguyen is one of them. When I spoke to her, she began by describing what her neighborhood looked like when she returned briefly after evacuating.
Oh, gosh. It just was unrecognizable. I mean, it just looked like nuclear warfare, really. I mean, it was buildings burned down, things that were unrecognizable, and it just felt just so sad to see this, like, beautiful community just turn into rubble and ash.
Yeah. When you connect with neighbors and friends, how do you even begin the conversations?
Well, we check in with them. You know, a lot of it is we're talking about logistics right now. And it's so hard, right? We're in this emotional state, but you also have to be proactive about things. We're trying to remind each other of next steps and things to do with insurance and debunking myths that are floating around on the internet about what to do. And then there's moments of how are you doing, of course, and checking in on them.
One thing, I'm curious how you and your family are thinking about this, because on one hand, in a situation like this, a lot of people will say, my family's okay, we're okay, physical items are replaceable. But on the other hand, his home is a home, and you've built your life there. And I'm wondering how you're thinking about what this means going forward and what you've lost in this moment personally.
I've tried to talk to my kids about, we've always said, even before this happened, that things are just things.
Yeah.
And we tried to emphasize that to them. Yesterday, I was driving with my husband, taking the kids from visiting a friend and going back to my mother-in-law's house. And I said, okay, come on, guys, it's time to go home. And then my son, he's six, and he's like, we don't have a home. And that just really broke me. So it's really trying to hold on to those mantras and adages. And sometimes I go back on that too. I would always say things are just things, but then now I think about it and some things are special. I mean, we glorify the trophies that they got for swim meets or the drawing that they've made. So we've also have given value to those things too. And then now to say and to reduce it down to this mantra that things are just things also feels not right. I think for my husband and I, you know, losing the home has been really hard because we've come from not a lot. We're both children of Vietnamese refugees. So, you know, this is really like the, I guess, as corny as it sounds, right, the quintessential, like, American dream.
Yeah.
You go, you know, work hard, you build a house, and we've been there for 10 years, and it felt so prideful for us to be able to have that home. And to see that all being kind of reduced to nothing has been really tough for us.
That is Joan Nguyen. Thank you so much, and good luck with sorting through all of this over the next few weeks and months.
Thank you so much.
For years, Meta tried to curb the spread of false information and hate speech on Facebook and Instagram. Here's CEO Mark Zuckerberg speaking at Georgetown University back in 2019.
No one tells us that they want to see misinformation. Right? That's why we work with independent fact checkers to stop hoaxes that are going viral from spreading.
But this past week, Zuckerberg said those efforts were a mistake.
We tried in good faith to address those concerns without becoming the arbiters of truth. But the fact checkers have just been too politically biased and have destroyed more trust than they've created, especially in the U.S.
Zuckerberg is now getting rid of professional fact checks and other speech rules on Facebook and Instagram in the U.S. He made this announcement, of course, weeks before Donald Trump returns to the White House, and he nodded to the political climate in his announcement. We're going to spend a few minutes zooming out to talk about why this shift happened and what it means for information on the internet. I'm going to do that with NPR's Woojing Nan and Shannon Bond, who both cover how information travels around online. Hey there.
Hello.
Hello.
Before we dive in, I will note that Meta is an NPR sponsor, but we report on them like any other company we cover. Let's start with this, though. We just heard what sounds like a really big evolution by Mark Zuckerberg. So how do we get to this place?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing we can say about Mark Zuckerberg is that he consistently reacts to pressure from the public and from people in power. You know, this whole thing about fact-checking, content moderation on Facebook, this all started after the 2016 election and the revelations that Russia had used Facebook and other platforms to try to manipulate American voters. And so under a lot of pressure, Facebook introduced these measures meant to deal with false information and this kind of manipulation, including partnering with outside fact-checkers. You know, and then I think from there, content moderation really hit a peak during the pandemic and the 2020 election. January 6, 2021 turned out to be a turning point, right? Facebook and other sites banned Trump. And what had been this backlash from many folks on the right who had been complaining that companies like Meta were stifling their speech, it really escalated after that. It turned into this coordinated campaign casting content moderation and fact-checking as censorship. And so I think what we can see from this week's announcement is it really signals the success of that campaign. Here's Zuckerberg embracing this view we have long heard from Trump and his allies.
Yeah, to the point where Zuckerberg said in this announcement that fact-checkers were part of the problem. Let's take a moment and fact-check that. How exactly did the system work, and what influence did the fact-checkers have on Facebook?
Fact-checkers like tipsters to Meta. They monitor the platforms, they see what kind of dubious claims are bubbling up and getting traction, and then they check it out. They either add context or they debunk claims as needed. But ultimately, it is up to Meta to decide what it does with that information. Do they take the post down, do they make it harder to see, or do they penalize the user in some way? Martin Schenk, a co-founder of Lead Stories, one of Meta's fact-checking partners here in the United States, says this was the first time he heard Meta had any problem with the program.
In all the years that we worked with Meta, they never complained or talked to us about any bias at all.
For Zuckerberg's accusation of political bias, like, Meta has long exempted politicians from being fact-checked on its platform. That said, some of the perception of bias might stem from the fact that claims circulating amongst conservatives gets debunked more.
Mm-hmm.
But there is no data to support the idea that conservatives are being unfairly targeted on the platform.
Did we get any sense of how much this was actually working, how effective this was in terms of actually curbing the impact of false or misleading information?
So research shows that fact-checking does have an effect on people when it comes to individual pieces of information that it has fact-checked, although the effect only lasts for a couple of weeks if you don't repeat it.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of it, it doesn't add up to, say, changing support for politicians who repeatedly lie, at least not in the United States. Still, that does not stop fact-checkers from becoming a target for those who were fact-checked, including Trump.
Right. So going forward, Meta says it is replacing fact checks with community notes, which is, of course, the system that Elon Musk has championed at X. Any sense, Shannon, how effective that will be?
Well, let's start with how community notes works on X. So users can propose notes on posts that they think might be wrong or misleading. Then those notes get voted on. And if enough people with different views agree, these notes might be shown on a post. But Shank of Lead Stories says that's an entirely different thing than professional fact-checking.
The shape of the world doesn't care if social media users have a consensus about it or not. That's not how facts work.
And he also pointed out many of the community notes we see on X actually rely on professional fact checks, right, to check the facts that they're talking about. And Meta's fact-checking partners in the U.S., they had to sign on to a code, you know, affirming transparency and nonpartisanship. You know, these are professional journalistic organizations it was working with. When it comes to the people writing community notes, it's much less clear who those users are, what their motivations might be. And then there are other shortcomings to the program on X. You know, many proposed notes never get shown at all, especially when it comes to contentious topics that people disagree about, and therefore it's, you know, hard to reach consensus on.
Ditching the fact checkers got the most attention, but they were not the only changes that Meta announced. What were some of the other policies that the company changed?
So Meta also announced that it is going to dial back on the automatic content filters, especially pertaining to, quote, immigration and gender. So speech previously not permissible could be getting through now. Meta says that previous filters are, quote, out of touch, and if something can be said in the House of Congress, it should be allowed on the platform. Katie Harbeth, a former Facebook employee who now works on platform trust and safety at technology consulting firm Duco Experts, says that the devils are in the details when it comes to this change, and we don't have the full picture when it comes to how it's going to affect the marginalized groups.
I think those folks could be particularly negatively impacted on this, and may make decisions about not being on these platforms.
Meta already changed its community standards, saying that it is okay to call women property and that gay people are mentally ill.
Let's talk about the politics of this. As I mentioned, this comes just weeks before President-elect Trump takes office. He has cheered these changes. He and other conservatives really pressured social media to walk these policies back. What is the broader political context that we need to know?
Well, I think Meta is very clearly trying to get on the good side of the incoming Trump administration. And we should remember, you know, it's not just the pressures over these kind of policies. The company is also facing a lot of regulatory risks, including an FTC lawsuit about its business practices. And so this is not the only move Meta has made. This week, it also named Trump ally Dana White to its board. Zuckerberg said it would move content moderators from California to Texas in, you know, what seems to be a clear bid to address these claims of liberal bias. Here's how Brendan Nyhan, a political scientist at Dartmouth College, described all of these moves.
These were designed in the lab to appeal to Trump and his Republican allies. There's no question.
And look, Scott, I mean, other tech companies are also making overtures to Trump, but I think what is striking here is just how overt Meta is being about this.
Yeah. Yeah. That is NPR's Shannon Bond and Ho-Jing Nan. Thank you to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Louise Schiavone with these headlines. Fire crews in Los Angeles say slower winds helped in the effort to contain the major fires in the area this weekend, but conditions are expected to worsen as the week goes on. Ceasefire talks underway in Qatar were the focus of today's call between President Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The negotiations aim to bring about a ceasefire in Gaza after more than a year of war. The latest talks would see Israeli hostages released in exchange for Palestinian detainees. Deductions for state and local taxes, or SALT, as Congress now refers to them, are on the table as House Republicans tackle new federal tax legislation. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Pete Buttigieg ran for president once and may one day run for president again. Over the past 4 years, though, he has held a job that has come with a lot of potential political liabilities. He has headed the Department of Transportation, which means the supply chain snags in ports, the chronic airline delays that have swept the country in recent years, the collapsing Key Bridge in Baltimore, and the freight rail crash that roiled East Palestine, Ohio. All of those crises fell on his plate. Buttigieg oversaw big policy changes in many of those areas and ended up especially focused on the airlines, trying to make their policies a bit more consumer-friendly. He talked about it in a sit-down with NPR, and I asked him if the airlines' meltdown with all of those delays and cancellations in the summer of 2022 was a big turning point for him as Secretary of Transportation.
Honestly, in the first year, the big question about the airlines was whether they were going to go out of business. It's easy to forget just how drastic their condition was during the worst of COVID. They came out of that, and then we had the opposite problem: delays, cancellations, the way that passengers were being treated. And we knew that the past enforcement practices of this department weren't enough. So we got tougher on the airlines. The airlines responded. They grudgingly responded. But at the end of the day, we have fewer cancellations, more passenger protections, better results. And of course, we're doing that at the same time that we're also physically improving airports around the country. We've got more than 1,500 airports where we're doing everything from new security checkpoints to better bathrooms, all to make it better and easier to be a passenger in this country. I'm proud of that work, and I hope that that work will enjoy bipartisan support in the years to come.
Still a lot of problems, though, obviously. Boeing, I'll just leave it as the proper noun there. Flow problems. One of the producers on the story had the pleasure of taxiing for 2 hours on the runway at JFK a few months ago. What are the areas that you wish you had had more time to get done? What are the areas where you're waiting to see what the next administration does when it comes to airlines?
I really think there have launched that regulatory process, but it will fall to the next administration to make decisions about what to do in terms of actual compensation for your time if you go through an extreme delay. I know some of the airline CEOs have expressed their hope that the next administration will be less passenger friendly. I wouldn't be so sure, because I think that this is something that really
got signed into law. A lot of this is still regulations, though. How worried are you about the future of regulatory policy, given the very clear track record of the federal courts on
regulations? That is more subject to what a given administration will do. But again, I would like to believe that this is something that any administration can support, because I haven't got one phone call or encountered anybody other than the airline CEOs who wants us to go back to having less passenger rights the way it was just a few years ago.
Were there conversations in the wake of the big ruling last year overturning the Chevron doctrine about, okay, all the stuff that we've doing, we're going to have to rethink it? How did that adjust how you were thinking about regulations, and what do you think that means going forward?
that when we get it right, the results are extraordinary. And a good example comes from the aviation sector, where we're continuing to engage on things like holding Boeing accountable for their quality. But also the fact that over the 4 years we've been here, we've had about 3.5 billion people get on an airliner. And as of today, the number of passenger fatalities in a crash of an airliner stands at zero, is not something that that just happens on its own. It's one of the reasons why these regulations.
Administration, and we're working to develop that.
We are in a situation now where there's going to be another Trump administration, whether it's this particular regulation that we were talking about having to do with bodies on freight trains or a lot of the other stuff. What is your concern level? How much are you thinking about this constant flip-flop of regulation put in place, regulation scaled back, regulation put in place, scaled back again? How does that affect rail safety? How does that affect governing as a whole?
Well, of course, there's the risk that the next administration would cut. Still hope and believe that that should get action. If it's not happening right now, it ought to happen in the new administration.
What do you think happened there? There was so much talk early on, and then it just stalled.
I think the railroad industry lobby got its way. They didn't want it to happen, and it didn't happen. Even though there were Republicans and Democrats who supported it, I sure supported it, so did President Biden. There's no good reason that it didn't happen, and yet here we are.
Wanted to end by asking how you changed on the job. It's an area where it's not like you came into it as like, I'm a transportation guy with years and years of transportation expertise. How did you learn on the job? How did you approach it differently over the years? Like, I'm wondering, by the time the Key Bridge collapsed, what were you doing to respond to that you might not have thought to do or prioritized in day one on this job?
Well, even though I did a lot of transportation work when I was mayor, nothing can prepare you for day one of a job like this. And that's especially true because different agencies were involved in clearing out the harbor and getting things back up and running. And so just that coordination from highly technical processes to something like me picking up the phone and talking to the governor in the middle of the night played a very important role that I came to understand better and better the longer I've been in this job.
That was Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg. To hear more from that conversation, you can check out our podcast, Consider This.
Fox drama has a very similar feel. Molly Parker plays a callous doctor who gets a brain injury in a car accident and forgets the last 8 years of her life, and it's based on an Italian TV drama. Let's listen.
I don't know what I did or who I am now, but I wanted to be a doctor my entire life, and I don't think I can give that up.
I know, very dramatic. Yeah. And there's also The Pitt. Now, this drama on Max stars Noah Wiley.
Okay. Well, that being said, let's shift genres. An even more classic genre, the Western. I've seen a lot of press for a new show called American Primeval. What's going on with that?
So this comes to Netflix from Peter Berg, who directed and co-wrote the script for the film Friday Night Lights, and Mark L. Smith, who wrote the script for Twisters and co-wrote the script for The Revenant. And like The Revenant, this is a gritty story about the American frontier. This time it's set in 1857 Utah, where white settlers.
Ever seen in television. Remind us of what we need to know going into Severance season two.
Well, you know, I felt like we could do a whole segment just on this show, but Severance debuted on Apple TV Plus way back in 2022, and it was centered on these people who worked in an office where their memories were severed between work and home. So at home, they don't remember work and vice versa. And towards the end of the first season, we realized that meant there were two different people living in one body, with one only remembering what it's like to live in a windowless office, working like hamsters on tasks which didn't seem to have any meaning. So as the season begins, we see fallout from the people inside, they're called innies, attempting to find out about their lives outside the company. That happened in the last episode of last season. Now, I got a pro tip for everybody. You really should watch at least that last episode from the first season, just so you get caught up on where all the characters are and what the issues are at hand. Because once the second season starts, they don't do a lot to catch you up. Mm-hmm. You may want to watch the whole first season. So Yo's character in the Section 31 movie is in the regular Trek universe and winds up joining this black ops unit called Section 31 to help stop an invasion from the old universe. It's an interesting idea, because how does a black ops unit even exist in the perfect world of Trek, right? I kind of wish the movie, which is super jam-packed with stuff, spent a little more time on this idea. It was initially announced by Paramount Plus as a series a long time ago, but after Yo won an Oscar in 2023,
This is NPR News.
The wildfires raging in Los Angeles have devastated entire neighborhoods and lives, and they've also disrupted the entertainment industry, just as Hollywood's award season.
Life imitating art.
Actress Jamie Lee Curtis was in tears when she went on The Tonight Show Wednesday night while her Pacific Palisades neighborhood was being decimated by the fires.
It's just a catastrophe. This is literally where I live. Everything. The market I shop in, the schools my kids go to, friends, many friends now have lost their homes.
Curtis and her husband, Christopher Guest, pledged $1 million to support wildfire relief efforts. Those who work in Hollywood, nearly 30% of the country's film and TV workers live in this part of California, according to the latest reports from LA's Otis College of Art and Design. And that includes behind-the-scenes writers, editors, camera operators, makeup artists, caterers, and so on. And it's not possible yet to know how many of those people who work on or who support TV shows and movies have been directly affected by these fires.
A lot of film shoots are happening in LA every single day. Do we have a sense yet how the fires are impacting productions that are going on?
That Hollywood productions are leaving Los Angeles for Georgia, Canada, and the UK, places offering lucrative tax credits. California's Governor Gavin Newsom has proposed more than doubling the state's tax credits for film and TV productions, but that hasn't passed yet.
And of course, the awards season just started, and that really is such a big part of the industry and the broader LA economy. Can you tell us what the fires might mean for those upcoming events?
Yeah, well, there were some red carpet events that got canceled this past week, like the premiere. Instagram, and she urged TV networks to cancel the telecast of upcoming Hollywood award shows and instead to donate the revenue they would have gotten to victims of the fires and to the firefighters.
That is Mendalee Del Barco, NPR's entertainment correspondent based in Los Angeles. Thanks so much and stay safe.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
I'm Louise Schiavone with these headlines. California is sending an additional... that President-elect Trump's talk about making Canada a 51st state is distracting public attention from the harm of the steep tariffs that Trump has been threatening. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Pew Charitable Trusts, telling stories behind data and trends that shape our world today through its podcast, After the Fact. A healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Duke Divinity Professor Kate Bowler was 30. Bowler sat down with Rachel Martin on Wildcard to answer questions about her life pulled from a deck of cards. Here's Rachel.
One, two, or three?
One.
One. What do you wish you could let go of?
I would love to let go of always... Measuring. And mm-hmm. I don't think that's, I think we're supposed to get worse at some things because we're not paying any attention to it. And we found something better to focus on. I wish for everyone that they didn't wake up and think about how much they weigh in the morning. I mean, just what a waste of time.
Yeah.
Waste of a good woman over here. It's just caring.
Yeah. So now I go one step deeper and ask you to share, if you would be willing to, what's a thing that you find your
I was like, Kate, this is the amount of time I have. This is the amount of energy I have. Like, how do I spend my life? But the metaphor of spending is really corrosive. Yeah. So then I find it much more difficult to actually focus on some of the really lovely things that I actually need in my life that are not very measurable. Like, I don't read not useful things very often because I'm always trying to put in the time. like this when I got sick. And now I'm an efficiency monster and I can't undo it.
Okay. Three more cards. One, two, or
three.
Do you think there's any part of us that lives on after we die?
Yes, 100%. Absolutely.
Which part?
The eyeballs, mostly. They're the last to decompose. I mean, it's so... It's even in just how we remember people, like what made them this and not that, like mm-hmm. what odd specificity like made that person's laugh and made it like a wicked part of their sense of humor. And I just think there's this delicious distilled absurdity, this like tragicomedy that is us. And I think that pressed into the rare diamond that is our soul, we just, that gets to, that just gets to live forever.
How much does
people talking about heaven, because I really wanted to be super careful about how he understood.
Yeah.
I mean, kind of what we believe as Christians, but whether he should be scared for me, his mom. And so I always bought these little like dolls of with like anatomical organs. And I was like, right now I have a mistake in this one. And then we'd like take it out and be like, this is a colon. It's just like, I found that the more like concrete and physical and specific I got, it would feel. Yeah. And so I've always been really careful about how sick he believes that I am at any time.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I've always wanted him to know in every version, like, this God we love means that when it comes to love, we will never be apart. And also, I don't want to go anywhere in which I can't smell your skin and
Kate, thank you so much.
Oh my gosh, my pleasure.
To hear more of that conversation, you can follow the Wild Card Podcast. Tens of thousands of years ago, nearly two dozen kangaroo species vanished as part of a great extinction event. Science reporter Ari Daniel says hundreds of prehistoric teeth may now help paleontologists figure out why.
Kangaroos evolved from a possum-like ancestor. Then, some 8 million years ago,
Australia became quite arid. That was where kangaroos really hit their strides.
Many of these kangaroos went extinct, and the question is, why?
The question has been plaguing paleontology for a couple of hundred years. It really does come down to two arguments.
The first being whether humans who arrived in Australia around this time had something to do with it, perhaps by hunting the kangaroos or altering the landscape, or whether it was related to a change in climate.
If these kangaroos were all just feeding on particular sorts of plants, then perhaps climate change came in and wiped out those plants, and then they were extinct because of that.
This idea that their food disappeared relies on the kangaroos having been specialized eaters, which some paleontologists believe, based on differences in kangaroo skull shape and chemistry, that short-faced kangaroos fed primarily on shrubs and long-faced kangaroos mostly on grasses. Armin, however, wasn't so sure.
Adaptation does not necessarily define diet.
So he approached the question of ancient kangaroo extinction by taking a detailed look at the teeth of more than 900 kangaroos, a mix of fossils from a cave in South Australia and modern animals from across the country.
Whenever an animal chews its food, the food leaves marks, microscopic scratches on the surface of the teeth. If we scan them under a very high-resolution microscope, we can then compare what these fossil animals were eating at the time.
Armin and his colleagues found that most of the extinct kangaroos, both the short and long-faced ones, had mixed diets. That is, he says they ate both grasses and shrubs based on what was available. He suggests that starvation brought on by a changing climate may not have wiped them out, and the arrival of humans may have.
It doesn't rule out that climate change is involved in some other way, but it's very hard to tell the story without invoking humans in any way.
The research is published in the journal Science.
This paper is really helpful in sort of reconstructing what the ecology was, but I think it goes a little bit too far in trying to make the claim that these kangaroos were sort of already well adapted to variable climate change.
Larissa DeSantis is a paleontologist at Vanderbilt University. She leans towards climate change having more to do with the extinctions. So she says the new research doesn't capture the full picture.
It's really important to see if we can disentangle the impacts of climate and humans in the past so that we can better understand the impacts that we're having on current ecosystems.
This is a point that Sam Armin agrees with. He hopes the kangaroos that ended their time on Earth in the Pleistocene might help the kangaroos of today escape a similar fate. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel.
Ringo Starr is best remembered as the drummer of the Beatles. Always funny with a great one-liner. Maybe not necessarily the leading artist or visionary in the band, though he had his moments in the sun.
I'd like to be under the sea. In an octopus's garden in the shade.
Including one of the Beatles' most beloved songs.
In the town where I was born.
Ringo even dabbled as a country music crooner on what's known as the White Album.
Don't pass me by, don't make me cry, don't make me blue.
All pretty convincing for a guy from Liverpool. And now, more than six decades after the Beatles launched themselves into global superstardom, Ringo has a new country music album out called Look Up.
Keep your eyes on the skies. Don't look down on the shadow town. Look up.
Here to tell us all about it is Marcus Dowling, country music reporter for the Tennessean in Nashville. Marcus, always good to talk to you.
Hey, it's a pleasure to talk to you as well. I'm excited about this.
It's been out for a couple days. You've had a listen. What do you think?
Multiple listens. I got it beforehand. You know, it's a wonderful record. I had a pleasure listening to it. Ringo's one of those artists who he's been doing this for six decades. The thing that people forget is that for 35 years of his career, he's had Ringo Starr's all-star band. So he's a master collaborator and really understands, yeah, you know, how to pull the best out of everyone.
A lot of collaborations on this album. What jumped out to you?
Oh, gosh. Well, I like the inclusion of so much of what's happening in Nashville right now. Even outside of, like, the mainstream contemporary country thing that's blown up the Billboard charts, you have this Americana scene that's really exciting right now. So you have Larkin Poe, you have Billy Strings, you have an icon in that space like Alison Krauss. So you have these artists who are vibrant and vital to kind of, like, the underpinning of everything that's happening in Nashville who are all on this record.
This is interesting. I feel like there probably were some listeners who hear Ringo and country album and they think everybody and their mom has a country album. Ringo has one too, but you're saying, like, no, this holds up. This is good. This has a through line.
Yeah, so one of the fascinating things about this album too is that T-Bone Burnett, who most people know from being the creator behind the Oh Brother Where Art Thou soundtrack and also working with the soundtrack for Walk the Line, the Johnny Cash biopic, Ringo has an idea of what country music is.
Yeah.
T-Bone Burnett is probably one of the preeminent masters of the roots of American popular music writ large. So you put those two people together, you're certain to have something that is going to work for sure.
We heard a little bit of the title track at the beginning of the segment. Are there any other tracks that jumped out to you? What do you want to tell us about them?
Yeah, for sure. I could talk about this record all day long.
You really liked it.
I'd say that Thankful and I'll Never Let Me Go are great records too on here.
Never let me go. Never let me go.
One of the things that stands out to me is that you have literal Hall of Fame players on this album. You have Paul Franklin, who's a steel guitarist who plays the pedal steel, and he's wonderful, and he's on this album. And Billy Strings is playing on this record. Molly Tuttle, who's a Grammy Award-winning bluegrass performer, is on this record. So it's just this cool thing of, like, you listen to these songs, and you're getting these artists who are timeless, almost, for multiple generations in collaboration. It's really wonderful.
You know, I mentioned at the top that, like, it's kind of been this decades-long fad to kind of knock Ringo a little bit due to the fact that he was surrounded by all these musical geniuses. But you're pointing out he had that long career with his all-star band. He's been kicking out albums throughout the years. What do you think his secret sauce is? Is it that fact that he could just collaborate with anybody?
It's a fundamental part of his understanding of popular music is coming from the culture of the virtuoso players, you know, being spotlighted and also in communication with each other, you know, creating these songs that, you know, feel like if you're coming to this brand new, like if you're listening to, you know, roots-based American music, you're like, these songs are all great.
That is Marcus Dowling, the country music reporter for The Tennessean, talking to us about Ringo Starr's new album, Look Up. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That is All Things Considered for this Sunday. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great rest of your evening. We will talk to you again soon.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Subaru, featuring the 2025 Forester with an updated exterior design and an 11.6-inch Starlink multimedia interface. Learn more at Subaru.com. From the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. And from ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
¶¶